जय माँ. सो वेरी ऑफन वेन पीपल टर्न टू एसेज ऑन द गीता दे हैव अ टेंडेंसी टू टेक आउट द श्लोकास फ्रॉम द गीता मैच दोज पोर्शंस एंड पुट इट टुगेदर. बट दी इज अ रीजन वाई श्री अरविंदो हैज नॉट डन दैट. आई मीन ही नोज वाई वॉट ही इज डूइंग बिकॉज इफ यू रीड जस्ट द श्लोकास एंड देयर लिटरल मीनिंग then sometimes if the mind is unchaste it can lead to a different kind of understanding. For instance, on one side Shri Krishna says, and people quote this very often, he says that, well, everybody is bound by his nature, so how would coercion prevail? You should not coerce or suppress it. Now, this is an oft-quoted statement of the Gita, meaning thereby that we are what nature has made us, and therefore, this idea of coercing, repressing, all these things have not much meaning. And even Mother was asked this question, that we are talking about transformation of nature, but the Gita says that, well, how will coercion prevail? It is asking Arjun to fight, because that's his nature, to fight. So, of course, the mother applies it very comprehensively, but Sri Aurobindo brings out these elements in the Gita, which as an article of faith is different, but in real practice they can come in the way. And a scripture is nothing if it is not put into practice, and the practice is difficult, so let's acknowledge the difficulty. But even before the difficulty of practice, there is the difficulty of understanding. For instance, in the chapter that we are going to take up, Sri Aurobindo brings out these apparent contradictions and reconciles them. So one of them is, how will coercion prevail? That's that everybody is tied to their nature. So there Sri Aurobindo says, quoting from other places in the Gita, see, he is bringing together these different places, different things which are written, and takes it as a whole. Otherwise, we read a particular passage, like last time we saw inequality, samalost kanchana, meaning thereby you have to treat everybody equally, meaning thereby that on the surface you have to treat everyone equally. But that's not how Gita is saying. That's not also the deepest sense of equality. Deepest sense of equality is the soul's complete surrender and abandonment to the divine, so that it is there only to fulfill divine will and is free from all preferences, opinions, prejudices, ideas. It is not a state of passivity. Equality is not an indifferent passivity where one says, doesn't matter, kya leke aaye the, kya leke jaoge, what have you got, what will you take, you have come empty-handed, you will go empty-handed. All this that comes in the name of, Gita understanding. So the beauty of Essays on the Gita is that it brings out in different places, there are different aspects, and Sri Aurobindo weaves them together. This, one of the places, we'll see this in the chapter that Chapter 21, the determinisms of nature. So if all is already decided, at one place even Sri Krishna says, Yantra Rudini Maya, man like a fly on the wheel is caught. So at one level the whole theory of karma collapses if somebody logically tries to argue. If I am like a fly caught on the wheel, how can I be responsible for what I am doing? And people misinterpret Gita like that. So there Sri Aurobindo at several places, as we read, makes a distinction, and the way to understand it is in one simple image is that this game of life is taking place at two levels. One is this level, which we can call as a shadow play, where we think this is myself, which is one self that we are aware of, our limited surface personality. And there is another self of which the Upanishad speaks of and the Sankhya speaks of, which is other than this field of nature. So what we call as ourself is the reflection of this in the field of nature. Something like looking at the moonbeam in the river, we say it is the moon. It is not the moon. But can we discard it when we are actually going through the water? Yes, it helps you. So it's a navigational or a practical exigency. So the ego self is a reflection of something else which is deeper and higher within nature. So then the other problem is that, okay, so there is a self which is beyond this field of nature. There is the moon shining above, which is independent of the river. So the Sankhya philosophy says, yes, that is true. So logically your intelligence should withdraw, intelligent will should withdraw from nature and discover this true self. And when you discover, this game is over. Now you see the contradiction. Now imagine a person in whom the intelligent will has withdrawn from this field of nature. Let's say through equality and other practices, or simply by witnessing. So what happens then? There is a contradiction within him. Nature is continuing in its own way and the intelligent will is saying, no, I am Atmarati, I am in the self. So therefore the Gita brings in this third self, which is the Purushottama. And this individual self is here to fulfill the will of the Purushottama. That's why individualities have been created. But for a long time, before one is prepared for this great work, one has to pass through a training ground. And nature provides that training ground. So when we are being trained, then technically we are not free. And yet there is the sense of freedom. For example, I can take an example when in our military training, we were being given some lectures on warcraft. So, you know, it's very tiring whole day and you feel sleepy, so you sleep off. Now you feel you have made a choice, you can sleep. But suddenly you are sent outside the class and you have to do 4 chakkar in the ground. So you realize that is a real event I am describing, which happened because some of us were so tired. So we couldn't help, you know, we put our head on the desk and go out and make 4 chakkar. So now it may look as if it's a punishment, reward and punishment, law of karma, but actually it's a constant learning process. We have to learn to be awake, even when something is of an extremely boring nature. That's how we can, in a real war situation, if at all, we can remain alert and awake. So this is a practice. If we take it, there is no real war, there is nothing happening and I can afford to sleep, then if there is a necessity, then I am not really ready. So here what we are experiencing is a practice match where we think I am the master, and this illusion is necessary for us. That's the beauty, and Shobhinda will describe to us step by step. Because the same Gita which says that, well, man is bound to his nature, head to foot, Yantra Rudini Maya, also says that the soul is not just a sakshi, but an anumanta, a bharta, an enjoyer, a sanctioner. So how can it be the sanctioner and enjoyer if it is bound? So the first stage is when it is bound in nature. The second is when it is freed from nature. And when it is freed from nature, then it can become truly, completely surrendered to the divine will and be an instrument of the divine work, because that's what ultimately Arjun is being prepared for. So where does this idea of free will comes in? Well, when we are in nature, nature itself creates this illusion of free will, and it's necessary. So how much ever we may believe that God decides everything, and people do that, no, God is doing everything. So for your next meal, you are not going to wait at your desk. You will make some chesta, some effort. You will walk to the dining room. You will go to earn your penny. It's so strong. This illusion is deliberate. And it's part of the mechanism of evolution. So we can't just rubbish it by philosophical arguments. When Amal Kiran asked mother, that mother, is there a free will or not? And then he quickly added, mother, I know all about philosophical part. So don't tell me about philosophical part. You tell me yes or no. So mother became silent. Then after a while she said, yes, there is a free will. It has been deliberately left free. See, look, when it is said deliberately left free means actually you are given a freedom, like a child is given freedom. But the teacher and parents are keeping a watch so that if he misuses his freedom, he can be pulled. But if he is going through error experimentation, they know that how far does this freedom allow you to go. That story of Sri Aurobindo with Amrita. One day he asks him, so you are meeting this. He was meeting one girl at 4 o'clock in the morning. And suddenly one day Sri Aurobindo says at 4 o'clock in the morning, so Amrit, time for you to go. He took it as a sanction of the Lord. After some time comes and says, sir, I want to get married. And Sri Aurobindo says, marriage? What nonsense. So he asked him, sir, why did you allow me to go so far? So Sri Aurobindo says, to see how far you can go. And he says that even about Superman. He says, you can't create Superman without allowing this freedom. Now see, allowing the freedom is very different from actual freedom. It's like you are in a prison and you are allowed degrees of freedom. So there Sri Aurobindo says, you can look upon this whole process as a hierarchy. So there is the lowest level where there is actually no freedom. Man is bound by the mechanical determinism of nature. This is what is tamas. So there are three layers of schooling: kindergarten, primary school and secondary school. Kindergarten, you have to listen to the teacher. Whatever freedom, there is a degree. You can't step out, you can't just run away because it's dangerous. And the child also does not think about it normally. So in a state of tamas, life is mechanical. One abhors change. One doesn't even strive for change. One just seeks comfort zones. One doesn't even want to think. There is inertia, obscurity, the principle of tamas. So this tamas is needed at one point just to secure that the soul has rooted itself in a field of nature. It is like when you sow a seed. You sow it inside the deep within the soil where sun rays cannot reach or reach by, you know, through several layers. So tamas is like that. So here when a person is in tamas, life is driven mechanically. And this mechanically applies also to thought. Everything one does is mechanically. Whatever is, so there it is like completely you are submerged. Then there is the next level. That is rajas. So rajasic man begins to believe, I have the freedom of choice. But this freedom, most often rajasic man emerging out of tamas is going to misuse. It's like a newfound liberty. What happened with classic example is when Moses gave liberation, freedom to the slaves. So what did they do first thing? They came out and started doing every kind of nonsense. So Moses had to give the Ten Commandments. That's the origin, because he saw that they are not regulating their life. So we can say that the slaves in the prison of Ramses is complete tamas. They are bound. It's like a slave. You can't argue. You can't discuss. Your head will be chopped off. Then the slaves making effort to be free. It's Moses who is helping them. But they just believe that, you know, it's we, and they are running behind Moses, and finally the sea parts and they go. This is rajas. And then with their freedom, they start misusing it. Because they have the freedom to do whatever they feel like. They believe so. And then the Ten Commandments of Moses are like sattva. No, no, you can't just do anything and everything in life. So the third level at which nature begins to disclose, it's like secondary school. Children are given more projects. You have to do it. They have grown up. So it's you have to decide. Sometimes you can choose your own time for submission, your own way. So that's when sattva begins to operate. When sattva operates, then we make real choices based on thought, discernment, applying our understanding. Rajasic choices look like choices, but they are not choices. For example, one is going on the road. Some friend calls, "Are, why don't you come over to my home? Why, what's going on? It's party." Okay. Now, looks like he has made a choice. He's going to party. Then something else is happening. Oh, there is a nice restaurant which has opened. Why don't we go out at night for a good dinner? Okay, I'll come. So looks like we're making a choice. But these choices are driven by all kinds of forces in the world. It looks apparent choice. But real choice begins with sattva. So when one is sattvic, one says, okay, there is a party, I understand. But I have some other commitment. Or one thinks whether I should do it or not do it. I should go or I shouldn't go. So when one begins to consult with one's own intelligence, which has little bit become aware, when the intelligence is freed from this total vital activity, that's when the semblance of freedom comes. So ordinarily, in ordinary life, we will say this is freedom. But Sri Krishna says, no, no, no. This too is not freedom. But it's a necessary phase. If you go through this phase, you are being prepared for the true freedom. So then what is true freedom? In sattva, we are deciding based on what? Our understanding of a situation. Based on what? Based on my idea of good and bad, right and wrong. I may have gathered this idea from my friends, colleagues, children, parents, society, school, education, and I process, or I may have evolved it. People have their own ethical idea evolved from within, what is good and bad, right and wrong. So I put it inside and process it. So always life is between this side and that side, black and white, and shades of grey, and then I make a choice. Yet this is still not the divine will. And that's the whole idea of the Gita. Arjun has processed the information of war. He is a sattvic man. He is not driven by a blind nature's choice. I am going to fight them, give them back black and blue. What do they know? I am such a great warrior and these fellows have come to. He doesn't do that. So he has come to that stage of sattva where, based on his understanding of right and wrong, he makes a choice that I don't want to fight. Sounds very reasonable. And Sri Krishna overturns it, overrules it. He says, fight. Getting rid of the fever of your soul. That's how he describes. Vigata jara. So this creates a challenge for the human mind, because up till sattva we can understand. But there can be something which is greater, a choice which the divine will can make, which is beyond good and evil. This is another problem with the ordinary human mind, that, well, God is beyond good and evil, so I can do anything. No, you cannot do anything you like. You are caught by nature, you are a slave. It's like king can do, you cannot do. As simple as that. You may like it, you may not like it. Too bad. So if you don't like it, what happens? See the whole same mechanism. Supposing a slave sees, oh, king can do this, I cannot do it. It's unjust. All right. So you grow and reach that point that you become a king. So one strives, and by whatever means one must reach there. It's a different story that human kings are as much bound, more bound. So this is the process of nature, and that's what is determinism of nature. Its purpose is to slowly prepare the soul to deliver it from the prison of the ego. When it is ready. And when it is ready, that's the time that the soul begins to aspire for something beyond good and evil, beyond right and wrong, because those yardsticks are not helping it anymore. That's the problem of Arjuna. It is not being helped by any of the standard ideas of right and wrong based on scriptures, based on his understanding. And therefore he turns to Krishna, which most people would not. They would say, I will still act according to my rigid idea of what is right. See, that is where the problem comes. I will do it, whatever. But that's the time one should turn to the Lord, and keeping aside all these ideas, opinions, viewpoints, tell him that you are beyond the scriptures. You tell me what I should do. So this is where Sri Krishna, Sri Aurobindo is leading us. With this background, we'll enter into chapter 21, the determinism of nature. When we can live in the higher self by the unity of works and self-knowledge, we become superior to the method of the lower workings of Prakriti. We are no longer enslaved to nature and our gunas, but one with the Ishvara, the master of our nature, we are able to use her without subjection to the chain of karma for the purposes of the divine will in us. For that is what the greater self in us is, He is the Lord of her works and unaffected by the troubled stress of her reactions. The soul ignorant in nature, on the contrary, is enslaved by that ignorance to her modes. So we have a child studying in the school. He has to listen to the teachers. But imagine, the child has now passed. He comes back to the same school as a teacher. Then they are colleagues. Friends. He doesn't have to listen to the teacher. Now he is using the same mechanisms which sometime he abhorred. But with a full understanding. That's what the Gita describes as Krishnakrat and Akrishnakrat. And the Gita says, those who are the knowers, they should not delude the minds of those who are not the knowers. So what it means is that now the teacher understands. Now he should not confuse the children by saying, no, you are free, everything, you can do whatever you feel like. They're dangerous. This is, God does everything. We are just a tool in the hands of God. Is he really a tool? He's a tool of nature. He's a tool of Bhut, Pishach, Rakshas, Asur. You're not a tool of God automatically. So this is where the yoga comes in. If we are a tool of God automatically without any effort, then life is very simple. But this is where the Gita is describing to us. We are a tool of the ego and desire. And so long as we are a tool of ego and desire, we cannot say that I have arrived at my higher self and I am an instrument of God. So, he continues, because it is identified there, not felicitously with its true self. If we are identified with the divine, there is no problem. Not with the divine who is seated above her, but stupidly and unhappily with the ego mind, which is a subordinate factor in her operations, in spite of the exaggerated figure it makes, a mere mental knot and point of reference for the play of the natural workings. So, that's the state of an average human being. To break this knot, no longer to make the ego the center and beneficiary of our works, but to derive all from and refer all to the divine super soul, is the way to become superior to all the restless trouble of nature's mode. Somebody asked a question that I don't believe that Sri Aurobindo and Sri Krishna, Sri Aurobindo is further taking the work beyond Sri Krishna. Something to that effect. I don't believe. I just see, your not belief stands at the same level as somebody's belief. Belief and non-belief are absolutely both irrational. Because you don't believe. So, belief and not belief will stop you from exploring. More importantly, it will make no difference to Sri Krishna and Sri Aurobindo, except that you will remain stuck where you are. So you see how the mind can operate. Mental ego makes you believe that, I have thought about it. Not realizing there are so many gaps in your thinking. So that's the important part where the mind has to, mental ego, the knot of the mental ego. For it is to live in the supreme consciousness of which the ego mind is a degradation, and to act in an equal and unified will and force and not in the unequal play of the gunas, which is a broken seeking and striving, a disturbance and inferior maya. So you see now why equality becomes difficult or easy. It depends on the context. If equality is the path which makes me closer to mother and act according to her will, it will become easy. Because now it is being impelled by bhakti. I have to be with the mother whatever mother commands. But it will be very difficult and strenuous if we remove that factor and just say practice of equality to discover my higher self. Who will feel interested in the higher self which you don't know, you have never known? But the moment you say mother or whatever your divine deity is, bhakti. That is the demand of the mother. I'll practice equanimity. If it is heat or cold, I'll take it as her will. If somebody is insulting me or somebody is praising me, I'll pass on to her. That mother, it is yours, not mine. If I get riches and success or if I get failure and loss, I'll take it that this is how the mother wants me to live and be. That's when equality becomes easy. Otherwise, it's very difficult, strenuous. So this what? So page 213, everything in the Gita is even so interwoven, fifth line from above, and must be understood in its relation to the whole. The Gita itself makes a distinction between those who have not the knowledge of the whole, akritsvid, and are misled by the partial truths of existence, and the yogin who has the synthetic knowledge of the totality, kritsvid. That's why it is, one should never outwardly imitate the actions of a master. Because there are people who do that, they think Sri Aurobindo was in a room for 24 years. So I know people who shut themselves inside a room. They start wearing dhoti. They start increasing their beard. Actually, I have seen. And they start putting on an air that, you know, they are sitting in meditation. Are he is all compassionate, all love. By this imitation, why? Because one begins to believe automatically. So the Gita speaks of the knowers of the whole. That's why we see mother's ways of dealing with different sadhaks. What she would say to one person will be very different from what she may say to another person. So knower of the whole does not confuse those who do not know by the standard stock teaching. So we have this understand. That's why S is on the Gita. This is the point that I want to emphasize. That please don't equate it with slokas and their translation. That's why I have personally avoided. Because it's not needed. If we want to understand the Gita for the practice and to realize the great truths, what better way than to just read S is on the Gita? Except for the pride of that I know Sanskrit and I can speak Sanskrit. That's a different matter. But otherwise, all the slokas are there, by the way. But that interweaving of the text is missing if you read it, because Sri Krishna picks up one thing here. If you take it, there is somebody who has read only the chapter 2 and says, according to chapter 2, what Sri Krishna is saying is same as what Buddha is saying. I have seen people actually giving a talk on the Gita and then referring to Sri Aurobindo and saying Sri Aurobindo and Shankara saying the same thing. And quite, you can derive, you pick up some little writings and you can bring out that conclusion. So the beauty of essays on the Gita is it brings out all these aspects together. Which one aspect will be here, one will be somewhere else. Now a few lines below. A certain absolute freedom is one aspect of the soul's relation with nature at one pole of a complex being. A certain absolute determinism by nature is the opposite aspect at its opposite pole. And there is also a partial and apparent, therefore an unreal, eidolon of liberty which the soul receives by a contorted reflection of these two opposite truths in the developing mentality. How beautifully such a sentence is unparalleled. Eidolon of liberty. You know how when a foreign minister goes on behalf of the prime minister to another country, so he takes decisions which are binding. But if he supposing does something which is completely out of national interest, the prime minister can overrule. This is an eidolon of liberty. You are representing, but this representation is a representation. It cannot be absolute. It can be overturned. So this is how one has to understand that there is the sense of free will. It's an eidolon of liberty, statue of liberty. Thank God he didn't say statue of liberty. But in the name of liberty, if you do things, or in the name of the statue of liberty and spokesperson of freedom, if you are trying to undermine the freedom of sovereignty of other nations, pun is not intended or intended, you are trying to cheat God. It doesn't work because there is somebody greater than your idea of freedom. There is an absolute freedom. So this is what he is trying to reveal to us. Okay. So here Sri Aurobindo reminds us, we have always to keep in mind the two great doctrines. And then he speaks about the soul and nature. And as we have seen, that if you take only these two, then the logical thing is soul should withdraw from nature. Because if it's in nature, it will be unequal play of gunas. But then it creates a logical contradiction. A part in us is free and the other is bound. Because nature is still bound by determinism. So your actions will be, and there are yogis who do this, who even justify. They say, I am inwardly free. How does it matter what I am doing? They pass on. Now who is there to testify that you are free or not free? In the name of freedom, you can do anything and everything. So there is the third status, the Purushottama, which again and again Sri Aurobindo reminds us. So we come on page 214. The paragraph starting with the perception of the ignorance of our assumption of freedom, while one is all the time in the meshes of this lower nature, is the viewpoint at which the Gita arrives, and it is in contradiction to this ignorant claim that it affirms the complete subjection of the ego soul on this plane to the gunas. Quote, while the actions are being entirely done by the modes of nature, it says, he whose self is bewildered by egoism thinks that it is his I which is doing them. But one who knows the true principles of the divisions of the modes and of works realizes that it is the modes which are acting and reacting on each other and is not caught in them by attachment. Those who are bewildered by the modes get attached to the modes and their works. Dull minds, not knowers of the whole. Let not the knower of the whole disturb them in their mental standpoint. Giving up thy works to me, free from desire and egoism, fight, delivered from the fever of thy soul. So there is a stage when one is bound. So they should not be confused by saying God is the doer of all. Very too dangerous. They have to go through that mode, through their egoism. That's why often people say, why didn't Sri Krishna intervene when Abhimanyu was dying? Why didn't he intervene and throw out Shakuni when the game is going on? No. When it is the, in the very first few chapters he reveals, when people are moved by their egoism, the divine takes a back seat. He says, you go, you will reach that point when you will feel the need and you will turn to the divine. That's the time intervene, because that's the time when you are ripe. Otherwise, even if the divine gives you the so-called freedom, it will be misused. So this readiness. Page 215. So here he talks of the two standpoints, 214, last four lines. Two standpoints of action, that of the soul caught in the web of its egoistic nature and doing works with the idea but not the reality of free will under the impulsion of nature, and that of the soul delivered from its identification with the ego, observing, sanctioning and governing the works of nature from above her. So the first step should be to discover our unity with the divine. There is no real freedom before that. So all our will should be used in that direction. But those who don't have this aspiration, who are not ready for it, who just want to enjoy life, they should know that you are choosing and your choices have consequences. Nature has arranged like that. So-called law of karma. That you will go through the consequences. Because otherwise, intellectually, one may argue, if God is doing everything, how am I responsible for my consequences? No, sir, this mechanism of schooling process is made. You can't help it. You can't jump the school and suddenly say, I mean, some kind of schooling. You can't suddenly jump and say, I'll do whatever I feel like because everybody is free. This illusion of freedom, and particularly in a place like Auroville Ashram, where we grew up with this idea we are free. And why this freedom has been given is to progress consciously and deliberately. So that we are not bound by one way of progressing, 100 ways to progress. But if the freedom is misused to do whatever I feel like, then the consequences are bound to be there. They will teach us. You can do it. It's up to us. But when the consequences come, then we can't that time suddenly say, but we are free. You were free, apparently free, you misused it. Aurobindo uses a very strong sentence in Essays on the Gita. He says, when Arjun says that, no, I'll be the doer of this and that and my own people, then Sri Aurobindo says, what does Sri Krishna say? Those who have sown the wind shall reap the whirlwind. You can't that time say that I am free, I'll do what. Yes, you did what you did. Now the consequences will come. You may not like it, but instead of liking and disliking, you have to learn from it. This is the whole process of constant learning. Very painful, because man doesn't want to grow in consciousness. He wants to do everything just ready-made. So page 215, we speak of the soul being subject to nature, but on the other hand, the Gita is distinguishing the properties of the soul and nature, affirms that while the nature is the executrix, the soul is always the Lord Ishwara. So here comes that greater truth. It speaks here of the self being bewildered by egoism, but the real self to the Vedantin is the divine, eternally free and self-aware. What then is this self that is bewildered by nature, this soul that is subject to her? The answer is that we are speaking here in the common parlance of our lower or mental view of things. We are speaking of the apparent self or the apparent soul, not of the real self, not of the true Purusha. It is really the ego which is subject to nature. So this, we keep on using the word my soul, like some people say, I want to find my soulmate. So answer is, first find your soul, then the mate will follow. You can't find the mate and say automatically, oh, I like somebody so much, I feel it's your soulmate. Okay, you first find your soul. All else is later. So this idea of freedom, that's why he says that myself, I am free, I'll do what I feel like. This I is a construct of nature. It has been given the illusion of freedom. And you have to use it. Even if you believe in absolute determinism, you'll be compelled to act by that sense of free choice. That's the power of that illusion. Maya bhot thagani. Because it's with a purpose. You have to grow through that stage. Even if you believe that, no, it's written in the Gita, man is free. Okay. You will be compelled to make a choice. The snake will come in front of you and you will start running. You made a choice. You can't just help it. And then you will realize, I have to make a choice. I might as well make the right choices. So this is where we have to understand this philosophical discussion of free will and fate. Ends here. Somebody asked Napoleon, Aurobindo says that, you strongly believe in fate, then why do you plan? So Napoleon answered that, it is fated that I plan. Aurobindo quotes it. Some people say, mother will do everything. Now, you are using it as a justification. When mother will call me, I will come. So, what do you mean? A telegram will go from Auroville or Ashram, mother is calling you. And a ticket will be along with that. Call means what? It's like you have to feel inside. So, this is where Sri Aurobindo is ruthlessly exposing our hypocrisy, and he uses the word here, which on the next page, but before that, page 215, somewhere in the middle. Thus there are, we may say, two souls in us. The word soul, in the sense of what we believe that it is the soul, two souls in us. He uses the word desired soul also in synthesis, and the life divine. The apparent or desired soul, which changes with the mutations of the gunas and is entirely constituted and determined by them. And the free and eternal Purusha, not limited by nature and her gunas. We have two selves, the apparent self, which is only the ego, that mental center in us, which takes up this mutable action of Prakriti, this mutable personality, and which says, I am this personality, I am the natural being, who am doing these works. But the natural being is simply nature, a composite of gunas. The way, few lines below, the way to be free must then be to get rid of the desires of this desired soul, and the false self-view of this ego, having become free from desire and egoism, cries the teacher, fight with all the fever of thy soul passed away from thee. So this is why this understanding is important. Then, we can come to page 217. So there are higher truths, higher principles. Now, because now everything is available, we can read it. But there is the danger of misapplying. Man has suffered much more from misapplication from truth. So much. In the name of God, I do things. And what things? By the throne of the God. See what has happened in history. If you see the history of religion, people often ask, why did Sri Krishna drown Dwarka? And why did he ensure that his own clan people are gone? See, he knew, otherwise using Dwarka, they will build a monument over it. Not just for charging money, but they will govern as if the kingdom of Krishna is being governed from the throne of Dwarka. See, this is what has happened with religions. Sri Krishna knew, because there is the power there. It's the seat of power. Sri Krishna has sat there. He was not the king, but he was Dwarkadhish. So imagine, in the name of Krishna, people will do what certain religions ended up doing. So he ensured that there is no Dwarka. And his own people, who will start fighting with the Yudhishthira and the Kurus. We are the real people whom kingdom must be given. He ensured that this second power center was gone. See, what a far-sighted vision, if you see, which is where, why in the name of Sri Krishna, these kind of religion, organized religions, though people have tried to make it, but that is much more recent. But in India, it's impossible to make a hyper-organized, institutionalized religion. But they couldn't do it. Precisely because he ensured that this doesn't happen. Because it's so dangerous, that throne. If Sri Aurobindo has done it, and the mother, it's because now it's the supramental truth. You just can't turn it into a religion. But that was the risk, and so he has done it. So repeatedly he is reminding us that these are two levels of truths. To view these truths from below is to miss-see, misunderstand, and probably to misuse them. And we know the whole history of religion is a proof. In the name of Christ, people have killed. In the name of Allah, they are continuing to kill. He must be turning wherever he is, oh my God. But he has to take everything. So it is so dangerous. It is a higher truth that the distinction of good and evil is indeed a practical fact and law valid for the egoistic human life, which is the stage of transition from the animal to the divine. But on a higher plane, we rise beyond good and evil, are above their duality, even as the Godhead is above it. But the unripe mind, seizing on this truth without rising from the lower consciousness, where it is not practically valid, will simply make it a convenient excuse for indulging its asuric propensities, denying the distinction between good and evil altogether, and falling by self-indulgence deeper into the morass of perdition. See why essays on the Gita is important. Nowhere in typical talks of the Gita, traditional, I have heard, I am sure many of us have heard, this distinction with such a beauty is explained. So people either go with confused minds, Krishna is beyond good and evil. People quote, say, Krishna said, you can tell lie, you can do anything. Krishna never told lie, that's another part. Not even once Sri Krishna has told lie. But people quote, you can do anything, you can steal, you can kill, because for the higher good you can justify it. He is not saying that at all. So that's why these books are useful, only if we take them as yoga shastras, that they teach us the way towards a higher self. Then they are useful, and that's where Essays on the Gita has this unique part, that it teaches us the practice. Otherwise, just, you know, teaching the slokas and there. Page 217, last para. The Gita says indeed, all existences follow their nature and what shall coercing it avail? Now here again, another one. Which seems, if we take it by itself, a hopelessly absolute assertion of the omnipotence of nature over the soul. Even the man of knowledge acts according to his own nature. That's how people say. See, you look at Yudhishthir. Yes, but that's what Gita is saying, is something that there is a possibility of going beyond nature, and that's what Shivinder leads us to. And on this, it founds the injunction to follow faithfully in our action the law of our nature. Better is one's own law of work, Swadharma, though in itself faulty, than an alien law well wrought out. Death in one's own law of being is better. Perilous is it to follow an alien law. It means there are people who say, I am very straightforward and frank. They use this to abuse everybody, to criticize everybody. I am straightforward. But that means if you don't like it, it's your problem. See, I am straightforward. Impulses that are frank and straightforward are dear to Mahakali. This is the problem. You are just venting out your anger under the cover of being straightforward, which makes it worse. You might as well say, I am angry with you and I am letting off my... At least you are honest. Otherwise, this is called mithyachar. That's what Sri Aurobindo reminds us. So that's why he reminds us, few lines below, under inverted comma, on page 218. In the ambush of this or that sense, liking and disliking are set in ambush. Fall not into their power, for they are the besetters of the soul in its path. Few lines below. And immediately after this, in answer to Arjuna's objection, who asks him, if there is no fault in following our nature, what are we then to say of that in us which drives a man to sin as if by force, even against his own struggling will? The teacher replies that this is desire and its companion wrath, children of Rajas, the second guna, the principle of passion, and this desire is the soul's great enemy and has to be slain. So when people say we are being very straightforward, then sometimes you can say, okay, go and tell the man who may kick you out, that tell him straightforwardly whatever you feel. The most straightforward people become like mouse. See, this it's, that's why Shubhendu in one of his aphorisms says, it may be noble to fight for a cause for someone, but to fight for some harm done to oneself, that's too low a thing. So the same thing, exact aphorism, maybe next time I'll bring. It's very beautiful that you have to understand that these high truths are subject to misuse. There is therefore a distinction to be made between what is essential in the nature, its nature and inevitable action, its native and inevitable action, which it avails not at all to repress, suppress, coerce, and what is accidental to it, its wanderings, confusions, perversions, over which we must certainly get control. There is a distinction implied too between coercion and suppression, nigraha, and control with right use and right guidance, sayama. The former is a violence done to the nature by the will, which in the end depresses the natural powers of the being. So here, that's where Atme Vatmano Bandhu Atmane Vribhur Atmana. So if the nature is a Kshatriya nature, then I must fight. But if I fight to fulfill my desire, if I fight only to assert my egoism, then this is the accidental part. And the highest use of Kshatriya nature, which we see in the mother's dream, where she says, why not use our fighting instinct to fight our own nature? Ultimately the highest. Or at least fight for something true and beautiful. Don't fight for your personal advantage. And if you do it, we can't deceive God. We may take nice covers, but that cover will be thrown aside. So here, this is what Sri Aurobindo is explaining to us. that there are things which are fundamental in our nature and there are things which are accidental. And this must be brought out and expressed through Sanyama, not Nigraha. You must bring out. If you are a Kshatriya by nature, if you want to fight for what is true, what you believe in to be true, divine, beautiful, fight for it. But there also, Sanyama. See how Rama acts, even with Parshuram. How he acts with Maryada everywhere. Even Shri Krishna. He doesn't start lifting weapon any time and every time. With Sanyama. When he has to fight, he fights like a hero. But always observing some mastery, some control through the deepest self. So then he goes on to explain to us that how there are these three stages. Tamas, when the buddhi is completely involved in obscurity, even the most tamasic man justifies himself. He can justify anything. So buddhi is totally under control of the tamasic nature, tamoguna. And people even go on justifying, this is how our great grandparents did it. This is how we have been doing it in tradition. They are 100 very spiritual justification they would see. If they have read the scripture, this is what Shri Krishna says. This is what Lord Rama did. So that's why we see after abandoning Sita, Rama has to explain to his praja what is the basis of his action. So that this doesn't become a yardstick. Very interesting, if you read that speech of Rama to his people. So it is so important to bring that understanding. So there is tamoguna. Then there is the rajoguna. There also buddhi acts, but it acts completely at the mercy of rajoguna. Whatever I do, I can justify. There are people who justify fulfilling all their desires, saying, after all, I am having a money earned by honest means. So what's wrong if I am spending it on buying another luxury car? Good logic. You have not been dishonest. You are an honest taxpayer. You can do it. But you must know this is not what is divine action. That difference must be known. Not that it's wrong. But you are rajogun. You are bound person. You are not a free man. That much should be, one should be aware. So page 220, he reveals. Five, six lines below. But as yet the buddhi, the intelligent will, has not developed the full light of consciousness. Therefore, no responsibility can be attributed to the animal for its actions. The tiger can be no more blamed for killing and devouring than the atom for its blind movements, the fire for burning and consuming, or the storm for its destruction. This is the lowest level. That's why the consequences change as you ascend the ladder. If you are completely a person who is bound by every kind of law, society, the consequences are much less. People talk about Manusmriti. If you read the Manusmriti, the consequences for a Shudra are much less. The proscriptions are much less. Actually, that fellow can eat, drink, enjoy, do anything. His life can be completely licentious. All that is required is that he should, in material work, he should do it well. For Brahmin, there are so many proscriptions, 64 proscriptions, do's and don'ts. And the punishment is far more severe. It's not easy to be a Brahmin. Why? Because you have the knowledge. You are supposed to guide the society. So this is how the whole thing operated in ancient India. Not that we should bring that back. But in a sense, we must understand that the law operates differently at different people, to different people. Then page 220, the passage begins. Well, but in man at least there is another action, a free soul, a free will. Again, with the sense of free will, a sense of responsibility, a real doer other than nature, other than the mechanism of Maya. So it seems, because in man there is a conscious intelligent will, buddhi is full of the light of the observing Purusha, who through it seems, observes, understands, approves or disapproves, gives or withholds the sanction, seems indeed at last to begin to be the lord of his nature. Man is not like the tiger or the fire or the storm. He cannot kill and say as a sufficient justification, I am acting according to my nature. And he cannot do it because he has not the nature and not therefore the law of action. Swadharma of the tiger, storm and fire. Man's swadharma is to refer everything to the intelligent will. He is a conscious intelligent will, a buddhi. So this also explains, I used to have this question. If every action has to have reaction according to the law of karma, then what happens to the karma of the snake and tiger? See, it's a tricky question. Are they punished? It sounds so absurd. Poor fellow will starve. If you punish a lion or tiger for, you know, killing a deer pretty mercilessly, punished. No, he's not punished because there is nothing like an individual soul or a conscious intelligent will. It also answers that question, do animals have an individual soul? They don't have. They have a group soul. They are moved by instinct. There is no sense of individuality. Humans have an individual soul. It begins from the higher animals like bear, a spark. But in human beings, there is an individual soul. That's why the buddhi begins to become operative as a reflection. Therefore, we are held responsible and accountable according to the law of karma, which is not a law of tribunal of reward and punishment, but a law of learning through consequence. So, this is the logic. So, finally, he comes to page 221. But is the condition of the predominantly sattvic nature freedom, and is this will in man a free will? Somebody who is doing according to the rule book, according to the, you know, whatever one has been taught by the scriptures. If somebody is doing according to that, Shastra, according to the law of the land, shall we say that he is not accountable? There is freedom. That the Gita, from the standpoint of a higher consciousness in which alone is true freedom, denies. The buddhi or conscious intelligent will is still an instrument of nature. And when it acts, even in the most sattvic sense, it is still nature which acts and the soul which is carried on the wheel by Maya. At any rate, at least 9/10 of our freedom of will is a palpable fiction. So, this is so important because very often, I remembered once a little interaction with an army officer. His wife had taken to Sri Aurobindo and one day he happened to meet me, very nice man, very sattvic man, very dutiful, honest, everything. But he didn't believe in God. So he meets me and first thing he says, I don't think I need to, she reads all this, I don't think that I need to read Gita or anything, I am doing all my duties. So I just passing the remark, that is karma, not yoga. Karma and karma yoga are different. So he kept thinking. I didn't say anything more. So karma is karma. It may be good karma, bad karma, sattvic karma, rajo karma, and you will move in that cycle. But karma yoga is where we use karma to unite with the divine and fulfill his will in action. Without that conscious process, fulfilling all your duties because government has assigned you a job or because destiny has put you somewhere, a dutiful husband, a dutiful wife, a dutiful king or minister or a dutiful servant, you are still bound to nature. It doesn't automatically set you free. That's the whole thing that Sri Krishna is leading us to. Toward the end, page 222. When we think that we are acting quite freely, powers are concealed behind our action, which escape the most careful self-introspection. When we think that we are free from ego, the ego is there, concealed in the mind of the saint as in that of the sinner. See, old time, ladies, sorry to say, no, we have been taught, husband is God, you must listen to him. Now, they will not say the same thing. Now you have a different possibility. So, but it is concealed behind nice words. The fact is, most of the time we are not doing it because it's moving out of your comfort zone. It's not easy. I mean, there is somebody who is providing you and there is a comfort zone. And so people accept all kinds of things. But which is okay. Whether you stay or don't stay is not the issue. But to use a cover of justification that I am fulfilling my duties, I'll be freed by God. No, you have not tried for freedom. I'm not talking out of freedom. If you go for inner freedom, you don't need anything. You don't need to leave or stay. Then you will be moved by the divine will, which is where we see Meera. She is moved by the divine will. Today she is in the palace and tomorrow she goes away. For this reason, even a high predominance of the sattvic principle does not constitute freedom. For, as the Gita points out, the sattva binds as much as the other gunas and bind just in the same way, by desire, by ego, a nobler desire, a purer ego. But so long as in any form these two hold the being, there is no freedom. So this part he says very clearly. The man of virtue, of knowledge, has his ego of the virtuous man, his ego of knowledge, and it is that sattvic ego which he seeks to satisfy. For his own sake he seeks virtue and knowledge, sometimes to reserve a seat in heaven. You know, that I am a very good man, I have paid all my taxes, done all my duties. All right, nobler ego, but still you are bound. That's not yoga. So finally he says, only when we cease to satisfy the ego, to think and to will from the ego, the limited I in us, then is there a real freedom. In other words, freedom, highest self-mastery, begin when above the natural self we see and hold the supreme self, of which the ego is an obstructing veil and a blinding shadow. And he closes this paragraph very beautifully. We'll come to the end. Last four lines. We are drawn towards it by the highest, most stupendous, most passionate, most stupendous and ecstatic of all desires. But we can, towards what? Towards the greater self. Because that's where real freedom comes. But we can securely live in it only when all desire drops away from us. We want the divine. That's the highest desire, if you want to call it a desire. Beyond the noblest desire. Most ecstatic, most passionate. But there is one last act, the last line. We have at a certain stage to liberate ourselves even from the desire of our liberation. You see, that's where all these commentaries on the Gita by the Upanishadic trained saints fails. Ultimately, you are still desiring your individual liberation. So the full truth of the Gita can never be revealed because one is not yet the adhikari. Gita is revealed to Arjun, who is seeking the true principle of action in the world. And that's what Sri Krishna gives him. So with this last line we'll stop. We have at a certain stage to liberate ourselves even from the desire of our liberation. Jai Ma. Okay.